Mr. Cochran, Reel 6. We're talking about your time on HMS Duff that you joined at Devonport in early May 1944. Yeah, well, were there any other features about the ship? What about the through decks? What did you think of that? There's not many British ships had through decks.
No, not many, no.
What did you think of it?
It seemed all right. There was plenty of space in there, and noticed that. There was loads of space on it. And another thing compared with our ships, on the upper deck we had lockers to keep potatoes in. There seemed more room than our ships.
What about the electrical engines? What do you reckon to them? Or would you just not notice?
Well, being a seaman, I wasn't, it's not my thing. But talking of that, before I joined the Duff, that's what her job was before I joined her. She was based in Belfast, and she used to come over to Liverpool, pick stoker petty officers and stokers and leading stokers up from Devonport, Chatham and Portsmouth, three divisions. She'd go across to Belfast and train them up for the engine room. When they completed the course on the engine room, come back to Liverpool, they would go back to the various depots then. And then they'd bring more up. And this is the way it went on. Now, when I joined her, the lads told me about that. And I said to them, well, you'll never see Liverpool or Belfast again. You're going in the Channel. This is what the pom-pom's on.
How did you know that?
Because it was to chase E-boats. That's what the bow chase was for. It was to go in the English Channel, chasing German E-boats to protect our shipping. And that's what I knew. And what surprised me with the Duff, honest to God, talk about Fred Carnos. I couldn't believe it. When they used to leave harbour, the captain, who was a touring RMVR...
Do you remember his name?
No. Canadian, he was. Used to play a gramophone, McNamara's band, as they left harbour. My name was McNamara. And they used to lap it up, the lads, but to me, on the Renown, used to fall in and for entering and leaving harbour, and the bugle would go, tension on the upper deck, or, eyes to starboard, or port, and salute the other ship. But here, you were playing a gramophone. But getting back to joining her, the next day, we picked up the anchor, went alongside the wall again, and picked up all dockyard mateys. And the gunner, who was a thin ring warrant officer, he was in charge of the guns. He came up to me and he said, now, we're going out to Plymouth Sound to test this pom-pom. He says, as you know, it's a brand new pom-pom, and I haven't signed for it yet. It still belongs to the dockyard. So we went out into the Sound and he said, now, don't listen to anybody else. I'll tell you when to train a gun and when to fire it and when to stop. So this went on. We went out in the Sound. He told me when to train and when to fire and when to cease fire. And after a period, he said to me, are you satisfied with the gun? I said, yes, sir. It's done everything we've asked of it. It's trained all right. It's fired all right. So he signed for the gun there and then to the dockyard officials. And then we went back into Devonport, dropped all the dockyard people off, and we went to sea then.
Now tell us about this pom-pom. Where was it placed on the ship? Because they didn't all have them, did they?
No. The only ones who had them was destroyers and frigates who operated in the Channel.
Now what about the 3-inch gun? Where was it?
We had 2 3-inch guns, A and B. They were forward of the bridge. They used to fire over our heads, A and B. And what he'd done, he had B gun as the SAR shell gun. Our job.
Okay, so tell me what happened then. So I'm taking you ahead there. What happened when you went to sea then?
We went to sea, and we went round the coast as far as. At first, we went to off Yarmouth.
You mean you were based in Yarmouth?
No, we just went off the coast of Yarmouth. Then we went into Harwich then. And for a couple of weeks or so, we were based at Harwich.
And what were you doing? Tell us what you...
And what our job was. We used to leave Harwich and get to the French coast for dusk.
Whereabouts on the French coast?
We were off Cherbourg at first. And what it was, we used to work... The captain class frigates with these bouchers of pom poms on. We used to work in twos. One was 3 miles off the French coast, the other was 9 miles off the French coast. And one would go in one direction and the other go in the other for so many miles and then they'd turn about. And this used to go on all night. And
you were looking for
E boats. And after a while, you got used to it. You knew what was happening. At midnight, the first lot of U-boats E-boats had come out. Straight away, B-gun had fired up, light the sky with the SAR shells, so that A-gun could have a go at them with their HEs. And if they got near enough, we could hit them with the pom-poms. And we had in a vicinity with us our own MTBs, and the idea was to chase them towards the MTBs so they could engage them. And this would go on. Then after a while you'd have a quietness. And 2 o'clock in the morning you'd be at it again. Those E-boats would be coming back to base. So you'd be in action again at 2 o'clock, round about 2 o'clock. Then after a while, that'd go. Then 4 o'clock, you'd get another lot of E-boats coming out. It was a pattern every night, you see. And this went on one night.
Remember anything particular?
Yes.
Sorry.
This went on night after night. And... what happened was, when you'd get to a certain part of the coast on your run, you'd be engaged by the shore batteries. Now, if you were 3 miles in, you'd hear them going over. They were going past you, they were missing you. Now, if you were 9 miles off, they were falling short of you. So, in our Admiralty, whoever thought of this was good, because... There was at least two lots of batteries that used to engage us. And I did never hear of anyone ever being hit by them. And one night in particular, I'll always remember this. They fetched a spotting plane out, the Germans. And he flew that low. If I'd had a potato in my hand, I could have hit him. That's how low he was. I thought he was going to take the mast away. And he flew right over us. And... I said to the layer, keep on this fella. Sometimes they machine gun you. I said, I'm going to get in before he gets us. If, as soon as I see any sparks coming out of his... So we trained on him.
With the pom-pom.
With the pom-pom. But he never fired at us. But he was definitely a spotting plane for these guns.
Why didn't you fire at him then?
Well, you were giving your position away. They'd have got their coastal batteries would have got our flash, you know, the flash of the pom-pom. See, this is why you never fired at him. But the only reason I was going to fire was if he'd have opened up for us, because what he would have done, he'd have took us and the bridge. All the officers on the bridge, but the lookouts would have got a, you know, perhaps the man in the wheelhouse as well. You know. But he never fired or said that for him. He just dipped right over us. Now, our own aircraft, when they were coming over us of a night, the officer of the watch used to tell us the code sign from midnight till 1 a.m, was red-red or red-green. And our aircraft had come over and the drop of the red-red or green-green or red and green, whatever the code was. And then it changed every hour in the night. And sometimes, if we seen the aircraft before, we'd fire to tell him, you know. But there was one particular night, I'll always remember this. We were on this run like this, and one of our planes actually attacked us. And luckily, it never hit us, like, but...
An RAF plane,
yeah. Because the markings, for D-Day, you know, the markings was white and black stripes. You could tell as soon as you looked at them. And I have heard later on in life that they thought we were too far forward to be English ships. They thought, you know, they thought we were German. That's their excuse. Another time...
What happened when
it
attacked you,
wasn't it?
This aircraft.
He definitely fired at us, but he never hit. He never hit us, like. He definitely fired, though. Fired the machine guns. Another night, we were off the coast again on these runs. And I seen this aircraft, and I knew it was a German as soon as I seen it. And at that time, they were firing the U-2s at London, the Germans.
V2.
At London, yeah. Well, this one actually fired like a rocket at us. And I seen it fire it. And it never fired at us. It fired towards London Way. And I reported it to the bridge. And the next morning, when we got it back into Harwich, the captain sent for me and he had to write a statement about it. It was actually a German plane firing rockets at shore in London. And I had to describe what the aircraft was like and everything. And he wrote it in his report, the captain. Yeah.
Around D-Day? I mean, was that the next thing? Or
yeah.
Or is this mostly during the D-Day period?
No, this is before D-Day, this. What happened was leading
anything
up...
Anything else happened before D-Day?
Yeah, this is leading up to D-Day, this.
Sorry.
What happened was... Before D-Day, we moved from Harwich round to the Isle of Wight. Ryde in the Isle of Wight was our base. And the way they worked it, there was 15 of us ships, all frigates. And we used to go out for 14 nights, and the 15th night you'd have a night in. And go out working in twos. And I'll never forget this particular night in question. We're off Cherbourg again. And in the first engagement at midnight, one of our MTBs, a young lad on it, had been hit in the foot, the big toe. Now, we never had a doctor board. We had a medic. They called him Doc, but he was a medic. And this lad was transferred aboard us. Now, everybody's seen him coming aboard us. And all as they could do, the medic, was give him morphia. And the poor lad was like this all night long as we were in action. And Next day, Jim comes back. Used to leave there at dawn. Come back to a ride. And we get some ride in the Isle of Wight. And there's an hospital ship just abreast us. Now, as you know, hospital ships, they had theatres on, operating theatres, all kinds of nurses and doctors. So I went up to the first lieutenant. I was a leading seaman by now. And I said, "Excuse me, sir. That boy's still aboard here." I said, "Why can't I put him in a motorboat and take him across that hospital ship?" He said, "He's got to go ashore." And that lad didn't go ashore till midday. Now, we was in Ryde at 8 o'clock in the morning. He'd been there over 4 hours on. He'd been there since midnight, just after midnight on us, getting morphia all night and just dressings what he could do. And that lad did not go ashore till midday in the Isle of Wight. And they had to go ashore to hospital. Now, whether he took him from to the mainland, I don't know. Nobody knew. But that shook a lot of the young lads up, that on the ship, you know.
Now, what about being promoted to leading seaman? Tell me what difference that made.
Well, what it was, in them days in the Navy, you used to get paid once a month on a ship. In barracks every other week. But we used to get paid once a month. Now, although the Duff was operating out of English ports, all the paperwork and everything was still in Belfast, attached to the base in Belfast, see. So we got paid once a month, and I was getting paid as an able seaman. And all the lads started saying to me, "You want to go and do this?" I said, "No, the Navy never rob you." And I said, "They're saving up for me." I said, you can't spend nothing. We're going ashore. If you go ashore on the Isle of Wight of a day, there's no pubs open. There was only two pubs there. And one opened at 8 o'clock at night when we were at sea. The other one opened at 9 o'clock when we were at sea. So you couldn't spend nothing. And when I got made leading seaman, I got moved then to the forward mess. Because you've got to take over a different mess, you see. So with me being a quarterdeck man, I had to go in the forecastle, and I was on the forward mess on the port side, you see.
Now, what was the difference in mess?
I was in charge of the mess then, you see. So I had to make sure everybody got the meals, and the cooks and the mess stitched, done all the dishing up and everything. So I was responsible for the upkeeping of the mess.
Now tell us about that. How did the mess work? Tell us about that.
Yeah. Well, how it worked was, on the Duff, we had a cook who done the cook for all the ship's company. The captain had his own cook, who was a lad from Carlisle. He was a young leading cook. Our cook was an ordinary cook. I used to cook for the whole of the ship's company.
So you wouldn't prepare the food for him?
No. What happened was, we would peel the potatoes. The cook of the mess would peel the potatoes for him and take it up in a net with the number of your mess on.
But you wouldn't prepare the meat?
No, the cook on the Duff done everything. He done everything. He actually prepared all the meals and everything.
And what was the food like?
On the Duff, it was quite good.
What did you get? Breakfast, dinner, tea?
Breakfast, you might get a couple of rounds of bread, say a couple of sausage one day. The next day you might get tinned herrings. Another day you might get bacon and a bit of liver. But it was always a sufficient. Nobody ever...
And then dinner?
Dinner was a cooked dinner. It was very good. There was
what did you get? What sauce?
You got... mostly roast potatoes, a couple of roast. You'd get your carrots or green peas, and mostly beef you'd get.
Gravy.
Pardon?
A roast or stew or what?
Mostly roast beef. Stew you'd get once a week. And the stew wasn't bad, considering that, you know, he was cooking for everybody.
What about your tea or evening meal?
Evening meal was like... at tea time, he'd get a cup of tea and a round of bread and jam bread or something. But the evening meal, round about 6:30 to 7, was a warm meal. It either be egg and chips, perhaps sausage and mash. One week you'd have stew, one day you'd have stew for your meal, you know.
So the food was all right?
Yeah. And also, in my mess, there was a Geordie. He was what you call a tanky. He was the fella who gave the food out. And he used to always make sure we had a little bit of extra butter for any mashed potatoes. And he always gave us a tin of evaporated milk, carnation milk, you know.
Condensed milk.
Yeah. He always gave us that for our mess. And if we had mash, we used to do well. We used to put a little bit of butter and mash it. Do this ourselves on the mess deck. And add a bit of this milk. And as I say, the food was... I never heard anyone moan or cry about it, you know. It was just plain food. There was nothing... wasn't like the Ritz or anything, posh meals, but you got by, you know what I mean?
Tell us about the rum ration on the Duff.
The rum ration was given out at noon.
Now, who would give it out? How was it given out? Tell me the whole way it was done.
It was, they had the thing there with God Bless the King on, the round thing, and they used to put two lots of water and one of rum. And then they had the big measures. As they entered the rum into the water from the casket, it was like an oval casket like that. And in front of the officer of the day, they'd undo the lock. And they'd empty the rum in then. And then they had two big measures there, and they had the sleeves rolled up, and they'd mix them so that the water was getting mixed to the rum. So you're getting two. And then the officer day would be there, and each chap for the mess would have his fanny, like a round thing with a angle on. And he would say the number of his mess, and the Jack Dusty, as we called him, the supply fella, he'd say what measure we were getting, you see. And the officer day would look at it, and he'd measure it into the... And this happened... Then it used to go to the mess, and it was my position to make sure that everyone who drunk the rum got a proper, because we had a measure, got a proper measure each. And they all had the proper measure. Now, if there was any over, you had to take it back to the officer of the day. And he made sure it was thrown away then. It was never saved. It was always thrown away. So that was the way the rum was worked out. Like, now, when it comes to splicing the main base, you don't get the two together, you know. I had it twice when I was on the Renown, and that was when the King was on. You know, when the King came to visit us in Scapa. And what he used to do, you know, when he was leaving, he thanked the Admiral and everything, and then he'd say, splice the main base. Well, that, you used to get it with your evening meal. 6:30 or 7 at night. And those who were underage, they would get a tot of lime juice if they were underage. Now, that's the way they worked, Splice. We had it twice under renown when the king came, when he came to visit the fleet. But that's the way they work it. Yeah.
Now, so what was a typical day like for you? You know, I mean, so you'd be in port most of the day.
You'd be in port most of the day. And what
would
you
be doing in
What we'd do, after breakfast and that, we're on a big ship, you'd have a padre and a priest, and you'd go to prayers and that. You didn't have it on here. You just turned to. You fell in, and the first lieutenant would tell the heads of the department what he wanted doing, you see. And in other words, it was like washing paintwork, washing the decks, washing paintwork.
And you do this while you're in ride during the day?
While we're in the ride, yeah. And after a while, doing this, you're always in the harbour every day. After a while, in the afternoon, there'd be nothing to do, really, because the ship was so clean.
How would you get a chance to sleep, though, if you'd been out all night?
Been out, yeah, that's what I say. Now, on a big ship, they'd give you make amends, but here, he never, you see.
So when would you sleep?
And this was the annoying part about it. And it got that bad in Ryde. There was nothing to do after lunch. So I took all the young ordinary seamen up to the pom-pom and started explaining the workings of the pom-pom to them. And the first lieutenant come up and wanted to know what was going on. So I said, well, look, sir, these are young ordinary seamen. The ship's clean. There's nothing else we can do. And I'm thinking of their future. Eventually they'll pass for ABs, I said. And they'll most likely go through for gunnery rates. And if they have the knowledge of the pom-pom, at least they've got something to go on. And I said, I'm not only that, I said, they're understanding what my job is. Have a night here. Because we were stuck up on that pom-pom all night on our own, you know. What happened was, he'd keep us at action station.
That's not during the day, though.
Sorry.
I still don't quite see when you sleep. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're out all night...
Yeah, that's what I say.
But you must have slept. You can't stay up
This is what I say. What used to happen, we were up on our feet all night. 6 o'clock, he'd send us down. You know, when it was daybreak, because it was May and June, and then he'd send us down then, and you'd go down, you'd have a wash and brush up, have your breakfast, and then 8 o'clock, I'd be up on top, back on the pom-pom again. And then, when she was in harbour, as soon as we got in harbour, what we'd done, we went alongside the oiler, topped up with oil. From there, we'd go alongside the ammunition up, put all the empty cartridges ashore on the ammunition ship, and bring fresh ammunition in. And this is what we'd done. But none of us ever seemed to get to sleep. You know, the only time we blokes got any sleep on air was after the 4 o'clock, after the evening meal. The props crash on the lockers, or, you know, that's the only sleep we had. Because I was on that, me and my guns crew, was the minute we left harbour, we were on that pom-pom, because
hang on, I'll come back to that. I'm still on about this sleep, because you can't sleep. This is what I'm saying,
this is what happened. This is what happened. We were up there all night. And at 6 o'clock at daybreak, he'd send us down.
For an hour.
That's all.
Right.